Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Let others focus only on the horse race and who's a better actor in the debates. We continue our election series, 30 issues in 30 days. We have 30 issues to discuss in 30 shows between now and Election Day. Last week's issues, if you were listening, were all on the theme of inequality in America. This week's issues are all about big government. We'll talk about the big military tomorrow, big energy versus big environment Wednesday, and big government health care on Thursday. Did you know almost 40% of New York City residents are on Medicaid? But today, 30 issues in 30 days. Issue 15, big housing. The Fannie and Freddie model of federal mortgage guarantees is in disarray. Obama and Romney are both promising reform. They both promise a rebalancing between home ownership assistance and rental assistance, for example. But what is government's role in helping Americans afford, a place to live? And how would the candidates be different? With us for this are Edward Pinto, former vice president at Fannie Mae and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Yannica Radcliffe, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, focusing on housing policy. Yannica and Ed, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning.
Good morning, Yannica.
And I'd
Thanks
like,
for having me.
I'd like to begin with a bit of history. This is a clip from 1933. We have actual audio. It was FDR's first year in the White House. Like today, the Depression included a housing crisis and a banking crisis, to some degree rolled into one. So Fiorello LaGuardia is is running for mayor of New York City, and one of his campaign promises is a big public housing construction project largely paid for with federal tax dollars. Listen as LaGuardia reads a letter to him as a candidate.
Here's a letter, and then he writes, "My husband is a pushcart peddler. We have five children. We are living in an old tenement house. No hot water. No heat. The plumbing is bad. It is unhealthy. What are you going to do about housing? I expect to do a great deal about housing. I shall seek to obtain federal funds for slum clearance and the erection of modern, cheerful apartment houses. Houses with a window in every room and a bit of sunshine in every window, to be rent at low rates within the means of small wage earners."
How about that piece of audio history? New York's Fiorello LaGuardia as a candidate for mayor in 1933. You can find that on YouTube thanks to the LaGuardia Wagner Archives at LaGuardia Community College. And spoiler alert, he did win that race for mayor, and he did get lots of public housing built with lots of federal money. So, Yannica, why did the federal government take that on as part of its mission, really for the first time in the 1930s?
Well, you know, then like now, I think they realized that housing is a key to economic opportunity in this country, not necessarily a way to speculate or get rich quick, but an opportunity to have access to good jobs, decent places to live, good schools, communities, and financial opportunity over the long run. And so they, in 1934, in the wake of the Great Depression, what the government did was stand up a lot of institutions that would provide stability and efficiency to the housing market. So they created FHA, the Federal Home Loan Bank System, ultimately Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and also deposit insurance, which would also allow people to put money into banks at low interest rates and provide low-cost money. So this was one way in which the government created a system of stabilizing institutions in housing finance that worked really pretty well for about 70 years to make home ownership a real opportunity for Americans. It helped build the middle class through long-term fixed-rate financing. What's interesting to note, though, the way in which the government supports affordable housing has many dimensions I think maybe your listeners tend to forget about. First, you've got subsidies. By far and away, the biggest of these are in the form of tax benefits. And for the most part, these work so that the bigger your home and the more money you make, actually the more subsidy you get.
This is the mortgage interest tax deduction, which they're actually debating now in the presidential campaign.
That's right. That's the biggest. That's about $90 billion. And then you've got property tax deductions and capital gains tax exclusions from selling your home. By contrast, the biggest funded program after the mortgage interest deduction, which is about a fifth the size of the mortgage interest deduction, is the Section 8 voucher program, which is a subsidy for rental.
So let me bring Edward Pinto in on that, because I did want to move through history a little bit before we get to the present. So after that 1930s era clip, flash forward to 1974 when Section 8 housing vouchers came into being. So, Ed, your understanding of history, was that from a Republican push to have the private sector involved as much as possible in housing assistance? So instead of actually building more projects, individuals would get vouchers and then go rent from private landlords?
Brian, I think what was going on is that you have a series of programs that had various failures, and public housing is a perfect example. So the program that Mayor LaGuardia was talking about ends up in many places. I can't speak to New York, but in St. Louis and Detroit and Chicago and other places, ends up crashing and burning. And a lot of the buildings ended up getting torn down because they were turned into horrible slums. And that was creating new problems. And so then there was a series of programs to bring the private sector in, of which Section 236 was one. You mentioned Section 8 in 1974 was the successor to these earlier programs. And they were all an effort to try to build decent housing, but in each case, either the expense was too great or they ended up concentrating people into areas that led to crime and other problems with the housing. That eventually turned into vouchers, which was a little bit later, which were designed to not concentrate all of the recipients in one area and have them spread out a bit more. But this has been a continuous process to try to solve this problem. We've spent hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars on the rental side, and we've spent an immense amount of money directly and indirectly on the single-family owner-occupied side, and we've created a real hash of the whole thing.
In the Reagan years, there were deep cuts to HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and flash forward again to really the Bush years. And I want to play a telling clip of President George W. Bush in 2002 and ask, would it be accurate to say that one root cause of the current crisis was a bipartisan decision to emphasize the so-called ownership society? So here is President Bush in 2002 announcing new initiatives to increase minority and low-income home ownership. This is May 17th, 2002.
First of all, government-sponsored corporations that helped create our mortgage system. I introduced two of the leaders here today. They call those people Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as well as the federal home loan banks, will increase their commitment to minority markets by more than $440 billion. I want to thank Leland and Franklin for that commitment. It's a commitment that conforms to their charters as well, and also conforms to their hearts. This means they will purchase more loans made by banks to African Americans, Hispanics, and other minorities, which will encourage home ownership. Freddie Mac will launch 25 initiatives to eliminate home ownership barriers. Under one of these, consumers with poor credit will be able to get a mortgage with an interest rate that automatically goes down after a period of consistent payments. I'm serious about this. This is a very important initiative for all of America.
President Bush in 2002. So, Yannicka, in retrospect, how do you look back on the kinds of policies that President Bush was announcing and emphasizing that day? $400 billion from Fannie and Freddie, mortgages to people with bad credit. It all sounded so mom and apple pie at the time.
Well, it certainly does. And I think we need to be clear about what actually failed here and what didn't. You know, home ownership isn't just about getting people a bunch of mortgages that they can't afford to repay. It's about getting people mortgages that they're going to be able to sustain over the long term. And that's what I consider to be legitimate home ownership. And that is not what failed here. It was more about Wall Street, unregulated mortgage lending, bad mortgage products that were push marketed. People were getting mortgages with fees and rate structures they couldn't possibly afford to pay long term. in the unregulated sector of the mortgage market. Borrowers didn't even have to prove they had income. You know, we have a law in the works. It's called the QM. It came up in the presidential debate the other day. And this law requires lenders to verify that borrowers have the ability to repay a loan before they make it. I mean, can you believe we even need a law for that? So, you know, here's the thing to keep in mind. Home ownership peaked in 2004. That was just as the subprime crisis was gaining steam. And the loans that triggered the crisis, subprime and private label securities, these really took over the market from the government-supported sectors in 2005 and 2006, when Fannie, Freddie, and FHA all fell behind. Wall Street and the independent mortgage companies were never subjected to any of these motivations to try to make affordable housing loans. Plus, a lot of those loans went for refinancing, and lots of the problem loans were for second homes and for investor-owned properties. So it wasn't about home ownership at all.
So Edward Pinto, as a former vice president at Fannie Mae, how do you hear? Do you cringe when you hear that Bush clip? And is your take on what happened very similar to or very different from Yannicka's?
It's very different. First of all, I was at Fannie Mae in the mid-1980s, and that was just at the beginning of the talk about undertaking affordable housing. However, starting in 1992 and 1993, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac later, HUD, President Clinton, all undertook a major effort to ramp up huge affordable housing programs. You mentioned this $400 billion. The $1 trillion program was announced in 1994 by Fannie Mae in response to a congressionally passed requirement for affordable housing. So that led to, in 1995, the Clinton housing strategy, home ownership strategy, which basically called for doing away with down payments, loosening underwriting, set us on a track for the disaster that occurred. It took another 10 or 12 years for the disaster to unfold. And yes, there were various phases in the disaster where different people were involved. However, the whole point is that we had a housing market that responds to leverage, reduced down payments, greater leverage in terms of income, et cetera. It responds to that. It drove a housing bubble. It was unsustainable. It collapsed. There was a government policy in place from 1993 all the way to even the present today to promote leverage in housing, and it ended up destroying the housing market that it was trying to create.
So here we are, I think, at a new turning point where the Fannie, Freddie, and some subprime mortgage models, the Wall Street securitization models, are all to some degree discredited. So are you both rethinking, from your various political orientations, the basic question of what is the federal government's role in affordable housing, especially for the people President Bush was focusing on, lower income, and especially Black and Latino lower income Americans in cities like New York? Edward?
Absolutely. I think we need a housing finance system that starts with the premise that it has to be built around high quality mortgages. You can't build it around minimum standards, which is what QM, qualified mortgage, does. It sets a mortgage minimum. You have to build it around prime mortgages. Throughout most of our history, most of the loans that were made were prime mortgages. You then say the private sector can handle those prime mortgages. They could be priced at market rates. The middle class can afford those loans, and the private sector, with appropriate regulation to define what a prime loan is, can make those loans. You then have a role for the government. And that role is to provide assistance pursuant to whatever Congress decides is appropriate for low and moderate income borrowers. That needs to be transparent. It needs to be on budget, and it doesn't get mixed up. Shouldn't be mixed up with the private sector. We have a situation where the private sector, and if you want to call Fannie Freddie, that's what little vestige they have of the private sector, if you want to call that conventional lending, they price for risk. Meaning, if it's a riskier loan, it costs more. If it's a less risky loan, it costs less. That's just common sense. The government doesn't like to price for risk. FHA does not price for risk. It prices the riskiest loan roughly as the same as the least risky loan. And that is a problem because that ends up promoting risky loans to the most risky borrowers, number one. And number two, it's very hard for the private sector it's impossible for the private sector to compete against someone who's not pricing for risk. So I think we need to separate what the government does and compartmentalize it from what the private sector is doing. Let the private sector handle traditional prime mortgage market and define a government role for the low and moderate income segment that needs assistance.
Yannicka, same question. Are you rethinking the basic model of what the federal government's role is in affordable housing tomorrow?
Yeah, so again, I want to remind everyone that the leverage problem wasn't so much with the borrowers as it was with the housing finance system, and particularly the pure private market, that even Fannie and Freddie had undercapitalized for the risk that they were undertaking. But I also want to remind folks that banks are not private market. They enjoy government support through deposit insurance as well as too-big-to-fail implicit guarantees. Fannie and Freddie are by no means private institutions. I think it's important to recognize the many ways in which government and private capital work together to provide financing across the spectrum. I wanted to talk about a study that we've been engaged in the last 10 years. We've been studying a portfolio of up to 50,000 mortgages that were funded in the decade leading up to the crisis by 40 banks around the country under their CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, and affordable housing type initiatives. And these are the kind of loans that were legitimately underwritten to put people into homes long term. The 70% of the borrowers in this portfolio put down less than 5% on their homes. Half of them have credit scores below 680 at origination, and the median income for these borrowers was under $31,000. These borrowers would not be able to get a mortgage in today's market. Yet, particularly given the circumstances that the economy has been through, they have performed remarkably well. The delinquency rates are lower than those for prime adjustable rate mortgages, half those of subprime fixed rate mortgages, and a fraction of those for subprime adjustable rate mortgages. And the secret here was that these borrowers got access to good products, 30-year fixed rate loans at prime market prices that were underwritten for their ability to repay.
Your point is what? Don't do away with things that worked?
Don't do away the things that work. We know good and well how to make home ownership available and sustainable for the majority of the population. And today, most folks still see, 90% of people surveyed think home ownership is still a critical part of the American dream. So I think I'm not alone in that viewpoint.
We're asking on our 30 Issues in 30 Days presidential election series how the federal government should proceed in the future to play a role in affordable housing with Yannicka Ratcliffe from the Center for American Progress and Edward Pinto from the American Enterprise Institute. And let's finish up by talking about the candidates. You know, of all the topics that we have done so far on 30 Issues, this has been the hardest to find clips of the candidates on. So here's what we do have, examples of how they each try to avoid the term ownership society now. Here is Obama using that phrase back in 2008 to criticize John McCain.
For over two decades, he subscribed to that old discredited Republican philosophy. Give more and more to those with the most and hope that prosperity trickles down to everyone else. In Washington, they call this the ownership society. But what it really means is that you're on your own.
So President Obama in 2008, and here is Romney recently changing the term ownership society to opportunity society in the context of criticizing Obama.
Barack Obama and I have fundamentally different visions of America. He spent the last 3 or 4 years laying the foundation for a new government-centered society. I will spend the next 4 years rebuilding the foundation of our opportunity society, led by free people and their free enterprises.
So, Edward Pinto, do you take anything meaningful from these clips, maybe the change from ownership to opportunity society as a point of rhetoric, because the ownership society is now seen as having failed in some way, or just any real policy differences going forward in terms of the federal government's role in affordable housing that you see between the candidates?
Well, I think the phrase government-centered society describes the housing finance system in the United States today to a T. It describes it over the last number of decades pretty well also, because we've got the most government-centric housing finance system basically in the developed world. And it all stems from what you started the program with, going back to the Great Depression and all of those agencies that were set up 70 years ago and have gone well beyond their utility in terms of today's marketplace and the distortions that they generated. So I think what we need to deal with is we have today a housing finance system that 90% of the credit risk is taken by the federal government. We have a housing finance system that 50% of the home purchases are done through FHA, VA, and the Department of Agriculture with down payments that round to zero. We have interest rates that are being held down artificially by the Fed to rates that haven't been seen in 60 or 70 years. And we have the Fed buying up most of the housing, the new mortgage-backed securities that get issued by Fannie, Freddie, and Ginnie Mae. This is nothing close to a normal housing market. And until we start winding the government back down and getting the free market back into this, we are not going to have anything close to a stable market. We have still a very unstable market. There are fundamentals that are looking positive, like what house prices are relative to incomes, house prices to rents, house prices to replacement costs. But you can't call a market that has those four characteristics that I just mentioned anything close to a normal market.
And
it's a controlled market by the government.
Before I get Janneke's view on that, what about the place of rental assistance, which is where it all started really 70 years ago? And as I look at the Obama and Romney campaign websites, they both talk about a rebalancing of ownership versus rental government assistance back toward the rental.
I think you need to divide the rental into two pieces, market rental, which is basically a business that's operated by landlords. They don't need subsidized interest rates through Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the FHA. They should be paying market interest rates just like automobile dealers and everybody else in the marketplace. You have, again, a low and moderate income component that should be compartmentalized, dealt with in a on-budget, transparent way, and that's really the role that HUD is supposed to play, and that's where it should be lodged. But you don't want to mix the private market in the multifamily with the subsidized market because, again, you create these distortions that are going to create problems down the road.
Janneke, same question to you on differences that you perceive between the candidates, Obama and Romney, and where does rental assistance fit into it, since everything we've talked about until a minute ago had to do with ownership?
Sure. Well, first, I want to point out that it's plain wrong to state that European countries don't provide government support for their mortgage markets. True, they don't support mortgage securitization the way we have in the U.S., but the banks are the main source of mortgage funding in Europe, and there you have very strong guarantees, both explicit and implicit, for the mortgage sorts of mortgage funding. And we've seen those guarantees acted upon through bank bailouts in many European countries. And certainly Canada has explicit support for mortgages as well. So I do want to point out that the U.S. is not really alone in that at all. But I think I have, in some ways I agree with Ed. It is important that we get a more holistic housing policy that makes rental opportunities also a viable way to get into communities of opportunity. And you do see in European countries there are more supports for rental housing so that you don't really have to opt for home ownership if you want to get into some of those opportunity communities. But at the same time, I think I agree with most Americans who feel, as I said, that home ownership is still part of the American dream. Today, 73% of households think it's a good time to buy. 67% would buy a house if they were moving. And the main reasons for this are to have control, security, privacy, a good place to raise your family. And so it's really just a question of who's going to have access to those benefits. And if you look at the home ownership gaps between whites and minorities in this country, between high-income households and more modest-income working families, there are plenty of good borrowers for home ownership, good candidates for home ownership in those underserved segments. And it's really just a matter of seeing that the benefits that are accruing to so much of the population are also made available to those households, hardworking families, who can get access to a home when they are ready to take on the responsibility of home ownership.
Go ahead.
Well, I just think that can still be an important opportunity in this country.
That's the same siren song we heard back in the early 90s that led us on this path of disaster. I mean, it was back then, the argument was there are plenty of people who could, if you just loosen the guidelines, if you did this, if you did that, we could create homeowners out of them, and
sure,
that was an unmitigated disaster.
The study that we're conducting at UNC of the 50,000 borrowers
is
just one of many
loans,
examples,
Gianna,
because in New York City you have cases of 60,000 homes where nonprofit organizations help families get into these homes, and they have minuscule default rates.
So how
the things that led to the crisis were the loans in 2004, 5, and 6 that were made by the unregulated, non-government-supported sector.
And you disagree with that, Ed?
I do. The whole thing started with the loosening of underwriting standards. We had flexible underwriting was the mantra that came out of the national homeownership strategy, came out of affordable housing mandates on Fannie and Freddie, and came out of CRA. And,
but I think people understand the difference
just a second,
between flexible.
I was answering that question. And it came out of that, and the this basically meant it was that you had to have weaker underwriting. And as you got weaker underwriting, the problem with mortgage lending is mortgage lending tends to go to weaker standards as a boom unfolds. And so we had the government pushing weaker standards. At the same time, you had this boom in housing. And so you had an unmitigated disaster develop with the government policy for the first time promoting looser lending. In fact, HUD, the way I describe it is we're the only country in the world that turned over our underwriting standards to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, a social welfare agency, through their control of the affordable housing mandates on Fannie and Freddie.
But instead, we turned over underwriting guidelines to the unregulated Wall Street and unregulated independent mortgage companies, and that's where you got the mortgages where people didn't have to confirm their ability to repay. And I think you can just look at the default rates among that around that lending, and I'm sure people in New York are pretty familiar with the story about what led to the crisis.
So one last thing before you both go. On Governor Romney, before there was the 47% video, there was an earlier open mic Romney fundraiser moment where he let slip, and Wall Street Journal reported it after one of their reporters heard it at the fundraiser, that he might abolish HUD if elected. A Forbes magazine editorial quickly praised the position. What would it mean to affordable housing policy if Romney were to do that? It's more complicated than defunding Big Bird. Yannicka, we have 30 seconds for each of you on this, then we're out of time.
Well, if there's any hope for rebalancing and making rental opportunities more workable and more viable for households in this country, that certainly lays with HUD. And I would say also that we need to understand the role that FHA has played in helping the economy avoid a much worse crash than it has had. It really stepped in to provide almost emergency financing to the mortgage market when the rest of the credit markets actually froze. So I think that's a very high-risk policy. And I would also add that it's easy for people like Romney to think about how much down people should be putting down 30% and 40% for down payments. But given the future demographics of this country, if we can't find safe ways to lend, to make low down payment lending work for families, there's not going to be much of a housing market in our future.
Ed, 30 seconds on HUD.
Yes, I think HUD was central to the collapse in the housing market. They were central to the homeownership strategy from 1995. They were central in their regulation of Fannie and Freddie. They were central in their efforts to get the what Yannicka calls the unregulated lenders to buy into the affordable housing goals and mandates that CRA came up with and extended to those groups, including Countrywide and others. So I think the role that HUD has played in these disasters really needs to be looked at closely.
Right.
And then once you do that, then you look at what do you do with this monstrosity that has created these problems.
Edward Pinto, former vice president at Fannie Mae and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute now. Yannicka Radcliffe, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, focusing on housing policy. Thank you both very much. Spirited
Thank
debate.
You.
Thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure. Thank you, Yannicka.
Bye.
That's
Bye,
issue 15 in 30 issues in 30 days. The government's role in affordable housing. And as part of our 30-issue series, we have partnered with longform.org to compile great journalism about the key issues facing our country. This week, we are looking at big government issues all week, housing, medicine, energy, the military, and today affordable housing. In this week's article picks on Long Form, we have a long history of the Cabrini Green projects in Chicago. The buildings were once seen as a model of affordable housing in America, but were torn down in 2010. Read that article and all this week's picks from longform.org on our website, wnyc.org/issues. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up next. WNYC's Bob Henley on terrorism suspect Abu Hamza al-Masri being extradited to New York to stand trial here in Lower Manhattan. Why is there no outcry, as with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed? Stay with us.